And welcome to the 7th episode of the Building Better Gamers podcast, a podcast where I interview people who apply their passion for gaming in a way that not only contributes to the community, but society as well. As always, the Building Better Gamers podcast is a proud member of the MTG Cast Network. Get your audio fix on all things related to Magic the Gathering at mtgcast.com. Also, this episode is brought to you by Classic Media House. Classic Media House is a cutting-edge multimedia firm providing independent musicians with music and media services to advance their career through promotional campaigns, show bookings, label submissions, and management. Full disclosure, this is one of my day jobs. That's how I'm able to hook you guys up with an introductory rate of 96 cents a day. To learn more, send an email to info@classicmediahouse.com and tell them I sent you. For this episode, I'm releasing the interview I did a couple months ago with David Serlin. David Serlin is a game designer and former pro gamer. He represented America in Street Fighter during a Super Battle Opera, which is the largest fighting game tournament series in Japan. He's known for leading the design in Street Fighter HD Remix, Puzzle Fighter HD Remix, and Kongai. In this interview, David lets me in on the metagame of crowdfunding and his thoughts on competitive game design. I hope you heroes enjoy it, and I'll catch you on the flip side.
Hi there, I am David Serlin, and thanks for having me in your show. I've done a lot of things, so I don't know where to begin. I wrote a book called Playing to Win, which is about playing competitive games. I was a competitive Street Fighter player, tournament player, and also designer of Street Fighter HD Remix, as well as Puzzle Fighter HD Remix. I have since started my own company called Serlin Games, where I've published several tabletop games, including the card game Yomi that kind of captures the concepts of fighting games in card form. Got another game called Pandante, which is about lying gambling pandas that we'll have an update on Kickstarter soon.
I guess we can start with Playing to Win.
Okay.
Are there any aspects of it that you would like to add on to it or make adjustment to?
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, I've thought about it a little bit. I think some examples, you know, could be updated. Not that the examples given are bad or anything, but maybe just newer games. Also, I have a whole section where I kind of theorize about what qualities make the best player, and based on my observations. But it would be sort of interesting to interview top players from different genres and see what differences there are across genres. But I haven't really seriously thought about updating it because I just have way too many things to do. So like right now I'm preparing for this Kickstarter for Pandante, as I mentioned a second ago. Also, my game Flash Duel has been out of print for several months, and so I'm going to reprint that with balance changes. And all of that is just kind of slowing me down to get to my game Codex, which is like it's kind of my reimagining of the whole customizable card game genre. It's a customizable card game, but it works completely differently than anything out there. And I've been kicking that around for about 10 years. I've finally gotten to the point where it's pretty solid, and I have most of the art done as well. So there's that project, and there's several others. I just have so many things going that updating Playing to Win hasn't reached like even the top 20 things for me to do.
Have you always been interested in game design, or was that just something you realized after being such a hardcore player yourself?
Well, I wouldn't say always. As a kid growing up, I never really thought about that at all. I thought I was going to be a physicist or a mathematician or something like that. And I went to MIT, which is one of, if not the top tech school in the world, so I was on the road to that. I played games ever since I was a kid, though. So I was a gamer since I can remember. But that's being a gamer is different from thinking about how games should be made or could be made. So where did that come along? It was really at MIT when I was talking to a friend who was a computer science major or had a computer science degree. He was a postgraduate. We were talking about adventure games like The Secret of Monkey Island, that type of thing, point-and-click adventure games. And I was complaining about some design thing. And he said, you know, we could make a game. And that was like the first time in my life I'd ever even thought of that. Because at that point, I was like, make a game? Like, how are games made? Like, on some other planet or something? I mean, I think the average person today knows a lot more about the game industry than back then. It was even more, like, secretive and out of reach. So that moment was when I really first started thinking about it. And I thought more and more and then decided I would learn something about the industry by going to the Game Developers Conference. And I just kind of slowly learned more and more and then got my foot in the door at an internship and so on. But I didn't really think about it until college.
Okay, so what was your original intention for college?
I thought it would be either math or physics. My father was a professional photographer and owned a photography studio. He's a businessman, and he always encouraged me to learn about business. So about halfway through college, I decided, a little earlier than halfway, I thought, you know, I'll take some business classes along with that math and physics stuff. And then about halfway through, I thought, well, I'll take just business and math. And that way, when I get towards the end, I could sort of go either way. Because I thought, maybe I should make a game company someday. Or maybe not. Maybe I'll just stick to math. And then I actually got to the point where I fulfilled both departmental requirements. So I managed to get both.
Nice. And this was in a regular time span, or did you have to?
Yeah, it was in a regular time span.
Okay, cool.
So it turns out I use the business more, but it's kind of nice to have a math background too.
Yeah. I'm sure it pops
when
up.
When making games, it comes up now and then. It's not so much the specific techniques of math or something. I think it's just more training and logical thinking or something.
On your blog and on your podcast and stuff, you've talked about the design of certain objects and stuff. Like, I remember one of your last podcasts, you were talking about the design of a clock. And I remember an old blog, you were talking about the design of a sign and how it, you know, meshes, how its actual aesthetics mesh with its function to be noticed, you know, and stuff. When have you, like, how long have you, like, looked that deeply into things?
Yeah, I mean, I do that all the time now. I don't really give you a glimpse into it except here and there, like those examples you said, but it's just like an automatic pilot now to think of design. But when did I start thinking about that? Well, I think it was in high school. I will credit the turning point of thinking about design at all when a friend of mine asked me if I had seen the movie Reservoir Dogs, and I said that I hadn't. And he said, well, we have to drop whatever we're doing right now and go see Reservoir Dogs. Have you seen that movie by chance?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he made me watch it with him. And he said, it wasn't the greatest movie ever. And I was like, well, it was good. I don't know about the greatest ever. I mean, maybe. But then we started talking about it more and really thinking about, well, how is that movie put together? It's very tricky and clever. Like, they're withholding a lot of information from you on purpose and then carefully controlling, like, you learn a little bit more, but that actually just raises more questions. And then you learn a little bit more about the answer to that question, and that raises more questions. And it was so carefully constructed that it made me start thinking about the design of that film. I hadn't really thought about that before. I mean, you go to a movie, you see a movie, it's a story, whatever. But this was like a crafted thing. And then I started looking for that in other movies and then in games and everywhere. And ever since then, it's just become, you know, more and more of my thoughts, I guess.
Is that an ideal game design for you? Getting little drips of information? And by getting people more involved, you're creating more questions? Or do you not like the idea of that?
I wouldn't say ideal because there's so many types of games. Like if you were, I can imagine a type of game that that would be really great at, like a single player story or adventure type game could be really engaging and suspenseful. Like if you started out in a situation where it was just, there were very few elements and they were kind of strange and you're like, what is going on? And then, you know, you learned a little bit more and a little bit more about it. That sounds like it could be really compelling. But then when I think about a different type of game, like a fighting game or something, it's not really what it's about. It's more about making a bunch of different characters that work differently and that are fair to play against each other and not too hard to learn.
Right.
And so on. So, yeah, I mean, it could fit for a certain type of game, but not others.
Speaking of not too hard to learn, how do you feel about the current difficulty in games? I think a lot of people are under the belief that they're getting easier and easier. Some people feel like they're becoming way too niche in their controls and such. Like, where do you stand with how video games are being played now?
Well, I think it's similar to the last question where you've got to break it down to what type of game are we talking about. So some people, you were saying some people say that games are getting simpler and simpler, or maybe not simpler, but easier right. to play. So there's certainly support for that. Things like at the beginning of a game, getting excessively many message boxes telling you how the game works, like a hit over the head with tutorials, your hand held. Like probably a game like Zelda wants to do that or something. Make sure you know how every little thing works. So I see what they're saying there. That's a difficult thing to do right. I think what's going on there is that the developer can choose how much do we let the player figure things out. And I think if you choose too much of that, it's just confusing. It's just bad design to just like throw people in an interface that they don't understand and that you don't explain. So you really should help them out, but you could go overboard and make it excruciating. And we definitely have that going on in today's world. So that's what those people are talking about. But then other people are saying the opposite, that games are more niche or more like more and more difficult, I guess. There's that too in competitive games, especially where there seems to be a romanticization or a love for complexity for its own sake by some players.
Okay.
Like this thing is difficult to do and therefore it's good. It's good because it's difficult. I mean, we see that just constantly in fighting games from the player base. And I think that's a bad attitude or bad belief. But it leads to fighting games' complexity just getting higher and higher and higher.
Right. So if you turned Yomi into a video game, what level of complexity would the controls be for that type of game?
Did you hear my podcast about that? Is that where, or are you just coincidentally asking?
Oh, well, I'm actually just asking.
Okay. Oh, no, you just happened to ask, you know, just the thing I had recently talked about.
Oh, right. So
I
thought, okay, cool.
Okay, so I'll give you two different answers to that. So my first answer is I kind of imagine. So take the level of complexity of, say, Street Fighter 2.
Okay.
And then on another end of the spectrum is something like Guilty Gear or Marvel, where those games are just way over the top and crazy and have huge combos. And so I imagine something a lot closer to the Street Fighter 2 end of the spectrum. Just walking, you don't need dashing, you don't need air dashing, you don't need huge combos. Simple combos are fine. But you could also do better than that game did on accessibility just by making the control motion simpler. So I imagine taking that kind of starting point and then going a little bit towards the crazy end with move design. And kind of the way that Blaze Blue did. I actually don't really like the game Blaze Blue. I like Guilty Gear way more. But I do like what the concept in Blaze Blue, that every character has a button that is like their signature button. Like, you press that button and cool moves for that character's theme come out.
Okay.
And it's pretty clever because you could say, like, so take Ryu in Street Fighter. He's got like a fireball and a dragon punch and a hurricane kick. So couldn't we do a control scheme where you had a special move button and like towards in that button is the fireball and maybe down in the button is dragon punch, and all of the special moves come out of this button very easily, like Smash does that.
Right.
So you might say that, but you run into some trouble with the dragon punches when you make an instant move, or sorry, an invulnerable move, be just one button press without any kind of control motion ahead of time. It becomes so reactionary, like you can just react to almost everything with dragon punch, and it's kind of bad. But Blaze Blue is very clever in that they can put as many moves as they want on that button, but not those dragon punch type moves. They can put those on other buttons. So I really like that. And so I imagined my Fantasy Strike characters in a game that's sort of like Street Fighter 2, but a little bit like Blaze Blue, in that they have this button that has all their cool character themed moves on them, but not the dragon punches. So that was what I imagined for quite a long time. And then more recently, I played Dive Kick. Do you know that game?
Yeah.
Yeah, so super simple. Like, it's so simple that people can't figure out if it's a joke or not. You know, it's just got two buttons and no joystick.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I'm impressed with Dive Kick. Like, I imagined ahead of time what it would be like, and then I played it, and I was wrong in what I imagined. There's really more to it than I thought there would be. I was impressed by that. And I thought, you know, there's so much to that game and it has so little to work with that maybe when I think about simplifying a fighting game, I shouldn't think like, well, if Street Fighter 2 was missing X, wouldn't that be sad? I should think, well, if Dive Kick had X, wouldn't that be amazing?
Right.
Yeah. I'm like, you know, if Dive Kick's already pretty interesting, if I could think more in that range, and I've imagined recently a very simple fighting game that's kind of between Dive Kick and a normal fighting game. There isn't really anything in that territory. I've heard people several times say they can get their friends who don't play fighting games to try Dive Kick and they'll like it. And then the friends say, that was fun. What should I play next? And there's like nothing.
Yeah, there's
play
no
next.
Progression. It's just, Street Fighter.
Yeah, actually, do you even know? Like, do you have like what would you say to that? What do you think would be the next fighting game?
I have no idea. I mean,
I don't know either. I was thinking like maybe Street Fighter 2 or Street Fighter 4 or Persona 4 Arena. But all of those are a huge jump.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, those are like my best answers, but they're not that great. So I thought, okay, if there's something in between, and I imagine like an attack button, a special move button, and a jump button. And I really only need a joystick left and right. I actually don't even need up or down. I don't need quarter circle motions or dragon punch motions or any of that. And I've kind of got it worked out, a whole game design that could use that simple control scheme. I think it could be good. So I've been considering trying to get a demo of that going and seeing how it plays. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see how that goes.
Seems interesting.
So yeah. So my newer take is to try something even simpler than my older take.
So I mean, Yomi being an actual video game is like a possibility in the future.
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. It's also a lot easier and cheaper to make the simpler game. I mean, to make that first idea, I said that's probably millions of dollars, literally. Like Skullgirls, if the Skullgirls team were to make a new game that was the same level of complexity of Skullgirls, they would need to charge about $3 million in development, I think. But the game I mentioned, I think, it just has so many fewer animations and fewer things to test, and it's more doable. So I can imagine making a demo for it and doing a Kickstarter for it and not having to get into the multiple millions, you know, to make it successful. So if we start on that scale, I think it's possible. And it sure would be fun. Fun to try.
That totally would be. So I wanted to ask you about chess too.
Okay.
What was the reception from like chess players and I guess like the community in general for that?
The reception, well, I think more of more about the game design and how it works than anything else. I don't know. I didn't really follow like what every person thought or something.
Okay. Well, I was asking because I was wondering if any like major player played it and like gave you any critiques or anything. So
well, I developed it the same way as my other games where players from anywhere in the world can just post whatever they want during development, and it's kind of a community forums, and we all work together. So it was open to all sorts of players from many different games, some chess players and some not. But I mean, a real like a high level chess player is just they have so many obstacles to overcome to provide feedback or assistance. Because any change is like, it's quote, not chess anymore. So it's difficult to deal with that. Like even when there's egregious, obvious problems, it's just really hard to deal with players who are so entrenched and invested in those problems existing.
I see.
I mean, let me give you an example. Let's say I was in charge of Third Strike, of rebalancing that, and I said, okay, day one on rebalancing Street Fighter 3 Third Strike, we're going to take out Karathros because they're stupid and bad design. And then you ask me, well, what did the top Street Fighter 3 Third Strike players say about that?
Yeah.
Well, they're not going to like that. You know, but Karathros are stupid. Just like draws are stupid in chess, having a 60%, more than 60% rate of draws amongst the best players in the world is like really, really unacceptable, and something has to be done about it. So that's why Chess 2 has the midline invasion rule. I think that's maybe my favorite part about it, actually. I really like the effect of that rule. Hmm. And you don't even need the rest of Chess 2 to play that particular rule. But the rest is cool too.
So when you originally wanted to do that game, you pretty much weren't really thinking about people who already play chess. You were thinking of like maybe trying a different audience altogether.
I don't really think about audiences at all when I make my games. I only think about what I think would be good. So I think that the problem of draws is a problem in chess, and so I sought out to fix that. No matter who plays it or doesn't, I view that as a problem. So I'm just there to address that problem. I think that a game with asymmetry, with a bunch of different sides, is just inherently more interesting and has a lot more to it. It's really great that you only have to learn one side in an asymmetric game, like only learn maybe one character in a fighting game or so on. You get to take place in this rich tapestry of all these matchups going on. That's interesting. So whether or not players out there agree with that, that's what I think. And so that's what I'm trying to solve. So, yeah, I'm very internal in my thinking and just hope that when it's all done, people appreciate it. The more they do, the more I'll be able to make. And if not, then no, well.
I'm thinking more about games, but what's a design flaw that's kind of getting to you right now?
A design flaw that's kind of getting to me. Well, I mean, the number one thing that gets to me is what I call uneven playfield games where it's like a competitive game supposedly, and yet players they aren't on the same footing with material advantage. So in Street Fighter, you pick a character, I pick a character. The characters are intended to be balanced against each other. Even if one of them is slightly stronger than the other, they're at least supposed to be fair. But that's not true in, say, League of Legends, where there's material advantage to be gained from grinding. Like you spend more time and then you get more power. That's like the worst sin. Just auto reject, boycott. I want nothing to do with it. I don't think any serious competitor should take that seriously, that system. You need to have immediate, non-random access to all gameplay-relevant elements of a game that you are willing to pay for, or it's, in my mind, kind of a fraud, like not a legitimate competitive game. And unfortunately, customizable card games are all guilty there, too. They have an artificial barrier of randomness and rares keeping you away from getting the cards you want. And my new game, Codex, does not. There are many things about my approach that are just really opposite from what's out there. So what I want is for the player, I want the player to have full power, everything. And so I want to do everything I can to empower them, to make sure they're playing with a full power deck, to make sure that their opponent must have a full power deck, that there is no way to even play an uneven play field. Because what competition is really about is us having the same kind of access to power, but what we're bringing is different skills, and that by improving your skill, you can win more. And it's a meritocracy that way. I think that's a really valuable thing for our society. I've gotten a ton out of playing inside meritocracies. When I go into the real world and I see things that are not meritocracies, I contrast that to the wonderful experience I had in real competitive games that were fair, and it makes me see the value of even play field and fairness. So I'm just extra disgusted and repulsed when I see supposedly competitive games that fail at that. And it just really bothers me. So that's the number one thing. I mean, I'm sure there's other things that bother me if you wanted more, but maybe you have other questions.
Oh, I'm kind of curious about the other ones. I mean, I can kind of understand what you're talking about with League of Legends.
Yeah, so Dota 2 doesn't do that,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah.
Dota 2 is just like, hey, you're new, here's full power, have at it.
All right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe another thing is, we've just already touched on, is this love of... I want to say artificial difficulty in performing things in competitive games. Artificial in that more difficult than it actually has to be. So just so I don't get mischaracterized or something, like some people think like, oh, if you want things to be so easy, you should make it all turn-based. But if you made Street Fighter turn-based, which I kind of did, that's a different game. It's like it's a different genre now. So I don't think you have to do that. I don't think like people should stop making fighting games and only make turn-based games. That's like kind of way too extreme. But there's things in a fighting game, or in not just fighting games, StarCraft, whatever, League of Legends, any of these games, where they're just more difficult than they really have to be to have that feature. And so what is the point? Supposedly the point is more skill ceiling. Like if a game demands that you make good decisions while you play it, and also demands that you perform very difficult feats of execution, then that's more skill in total. That's true, but it's like vacuously true. It's like true, but who cares?
Right. Yeah.
Because I could make another game where it's you have to make smart decisions, and also you have to bake cakes really well. And so that you'd have to have the cake baking skill and the decision skill, and that's more skill than if you didn't have to know how to bake cakes. And so the skill ceiling is higher. That's true, but that's stupid, because why is that what the game is about? And that's what I feel like when we play these strategy games like Street Fighter or StarCraft or something, and there's ways, possible ways in the design to make it more about the strategy. But designers intentionally don't choose that, so that it can be more about execution. I don't quite get it. That bothers me. I'm always seeking to make things as simple as possible to the players and get beginner players to the intermediate stage as quickly as possible. So I don't want all these barriers. Like if the command to do a throw in a fighting game is towards plus punch or something, I want it to really be towards plus punch. You learn that on day one, and on year after playing it a year, it's still true. But in some games, it's not true. It's like a mistake if you throw that way. You actually have to use a Kara throw and press like some other button towards and some other button for like 1/60th of a second, and then press two other buttons. And it's like a complicated secret command. It makes your throw range longer if you do it. But you could just remove all that and give everyone longer throw range to begin with.
Right. Yeah.
And so that's a specific example, but it's the kind of thing that happens over and over and over in all sorts of different ways in competitive games.
So do you think that's being done on purpose? I guess you say separate the player base, you know, between those that are, I guess, the hardcores and then like everyone else or something like that. Do you think that's being done on purpose?
Yeah. I think time has passed. We've been at making these games for a while. And so earlier in history, it was not so intentional. It's just like, here's a bunch of rules and how this game works. And if you really scrutinize it, there's kind of strange interactions in the rules. Probably weren't intended, you know, could be bugs, but or maybe design bugs as opposed to programming bugs.
Just, right.
Yeah, right. Like, I mean, the carrot throw is like more of a design bug. It's more just the way it works is a little wonky. So I think that there's a lot of things that are not consciously put there to make it harder. It's just that they are there. And then players learn them and get better at them. And then as time went on, game developers become aware of them. They're like, oh, that's a thing. That's people are using this tactic. And they seem to like it. Like, something I call the depth fallacy, like the wrong definition of depth, which means the wrong definition would be, I thought I knew how it worked, and then I learned a new thing, and so now it's deeper. A lot of people use that terminology, but that's a really bad definition of depth, because as you learn more and more things about how it works, more tricks,
right.
It doesn't actually mean there's better decisions. Like, it doesn't tell you anything about that. It could very well be that when you learn all, like, the super secret best tricky way to do something, it's just the best way and you should never do anything else, and there's like no depth left. But that's a common misconception. So players really like these tricks, and developers see that. And so I think phase two of all this is like developers thinking, oh, well, players like it, so we'll keep it. We will not remove or fix those things. And maybe we'll add some more in. And so some of these genres have snowballed into more and more complexity. And here and there, you see a few developers trying to do things differently. So Guilty Gear, I'm most impressed with lately. Do you know, have you played that at all?
I have not gotten series? To play it yet, but you know, I've been hearing about it. And
yeah, so Guilty Gear has always been very complicated. And I tell people it's kind of like the jazz music of fighting games. It's like, if you really know a lot about fighting games, you should probably play Guilty Gear, because it's complicated. There's a lot to it, but they generally really know what they're doing. They're putting together a lot of different elements from different fighting games in an interesting way. And as time went on, they tuned it more and more and added more and more. And it's very complicated, but they surprised me with this newest version, Xrd, Guilty Gear Xrd, and they reinvented it all. It's a new graphical engine. It's 3D now, even though it still looks 2D. But they really simplified things, and they seem to just totally change our course. Like, so many things about it are made with the intent of, kind of like I said earlier, allowing beginner players to play at an intermediate level more quickly. Like,
yeah.
Getting rid of bunch of execution things that didn't actually have to be there. And they really made bold changes too. Like, if you had told me ahead of time the idea for how Roman cancels work, I would have said that's a great idea, but they would never do that. That's too big of a change. But they did it. So somebody out there cares, I guess, about making things simpler and more accessible without necessarily being any less deep.
Right. Yeah. I've been hearing how they've simplified the system, and I think that's, yeah, it's really good. I think it's about time for them to do so. Plus, I'm pretty sure the things they've been doing in their other titles as of late to help newer players, I'm pretty sure that helped inspire them to just, you know, go for it in this game.
Yeah, that's a good point. They've been thinking about this in their other games. Like Blaze Blue, I actually found Blaze Blue to be not really simpler, but I do recognize that they tried to make it simpler.
Yeah.
they were thinking about it. Well, I don't even know whether they achieved it. It's maybe a different story. And then in Persona 4 Arena, you could tell that they thought even harder about it. As in that one, if you press the A button a lot, like the weak attack button, you get an auto combo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was a little bit controversial to some people, but I thought, hey, that's a great idea. Like, why not? All that really does is it means when you're terrible, you're closer to playing the game in a reasonable way. Like, anybody decent is going to do a good real combo in that situation. And now people who are bad got to do a sort of almost real combo. So why not? They also made reversal attacks like dragon punches, the simplest command possible.
Yeah.
So they were, yeah, they're really trying to make that game accessible. So yeah, I get you. So maybe by the time they got around to reinventing Guilty Gear, they had already thought a lot about this stuff.
So I'm kind of curious, why are you going the Kickstarter route? Let's see, your last couple projects have been Kickstarter. Are you doing that because it feels like it's like the industry standard at this point, or do you still think Kickstarter like still has the juice?
Yeah, so I've done 3 Kickstarters so far, and I have the very rare distinction that I shipped all 3 on time. It's like unheard of in the tabletop game space.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a thing. I know, right? I know, and the reason it's a thing is that Kickstarter has these forces that you just succumb to when you're part of it. And no matter what you say as the project creator, everybody who's backing it is going to say, well, can we change it in this way and that way? And can we add things? And can we add more and more things? And that's just all these opportunities to delay the ship date. So
right.
It's understandable why everybody's late on these things. I really try to say no to as much as possible. And I plan it out and plan like, okay, maybe we can add some things, but I've already pretty much figured out what those things are. And so that's already budgeted into our schedule. I try not to, in the seat of your pants in the middle of the campaign, like, okay, let's change everything around. But yeah, so you're asking like, why use it at all, right?
I guess I just would like to hear your thoughts on the platform nowadays, you know, why you're still going for it, even though your past successes have kind of proven you to, you know, be competent.
So I work with a company called GameSalute that distributes my games, and the head guy at GameSalute named Dan Yarrington, he was the original guy telling me, oh, you got to do Kickstarters. And I was like, oh, I don't really want to, like, do I have to? And he's like, no, you really do. It's really important. And I said, well, what if it's a project where I can already pay for the project anyway? And he's like, it doesn't matter. It's a marketing thing. You got to do it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so then I've learned a ton about Kickstarter since that, and now I see that everywhere, that a lot of game companies, they don't need the money, or if they do, they're asking for a ludicrously small amount of money, like a tiny fraction of what that project would cost.
Right. Yeah.
Just so they can have a Kickstarter. So there's some element here that, I mean, there's more than one factor, but one factor is whether you need the money or not. It's kind of as possible to get more hype, maybe, on these Kickstarters. I don't know exactly why, but that just seems to be true. Now, if that was your only reason, I don't know. It's kind of not enough. If you just want to 100% do it for marketing, maybe. I'm not sure if it's worth it. You've really got to have good marketing to make it blow up huge. So there's more to it. So my first one was Puzzle Strike. And on Puzzle Strike, I actually legitimately used it. Like,
right.
The point of... Okay, well, let me put it two ways. One point of Kickstarter is I want to make a thing and I can't make it unless I get the money.
Right.
So if that's what you did, that's like the most legitimate use possible. Now, a different use is I want to make the thing, and if we don't do a Kickstarter, I can actually still make it, but it won't be as good. Like, there'll be pieces missing or lower quality in the components or something. And so that's what Puzzle Strike was like, where I really wanted to add some components and upgrade a couple things. And the Kickstarter made that possible. So that's why I did that. And then I saw, oh, that worked. If I hadn't done it, I wouldn't – it was just too risky for me to spend that much money. And in fact, I've been to some – like how to get started in the industry, in the board game industry things, or I was on the panel actually, and the other panelists said, whatever you do, don't invest your money into like a full print run of board games just ahead of time on the hope that you're going to sell it. And I was like, well, that's exactly what I did. That's how I made Plash Duel and Puzzle Strike and Yomi the first time around. Yeah. And everyone thought I was totally insane and that no one should ever do that. So if they were here, they'd say, like, you got to do Kickstarter just to reduce your risk. Like, forget about the marketing. I mean, if nobody wants it and you're going to spend how many tens of thousands of dollars making it, that's just... it's crazy. So there's that. On Pandante, my next Kickstarter, I also... So that was more of the first kind where I needed it to make the thing at all. The thing I was trying to do there is I had this game where I'm like, here's the basic version. It's a reasonable cost game. But I want to do a very special, fancy version that has custom poker chips and the graphic design of the game that look a lot different than normal poker chips. They're beautiful and they're elegant and they're clay, professional grade. And it's just really, really expensive to make that. It's so expensive that I can't really make like thousands of those in the hope that they'll sell.
Right.
Yeah. So I did the Kickstarter specifically. I mean, okay, the Kickstarter maybe to the outside world didn't appear this way, but the reality is it was to make the deluxe version even possible to fund. That's why I did that Kickstarter. Okay. Then for Yomi, it's just a big print run and it's hard to pay for and the other Kickstarters worked. So I did it again. That was the most successful one. And so now that it's come time to do an expansion for Pandante and a reprint of a Flash Duel, I'm actually back in the same situation where I kind of want to offer... Okay, so it's expansion, as in like you already have the game and then you could buy an extra thing.
Right.
So one element here is there is in this expansion, if you win the game by lying, which is like kind of the ultimate objective, like the greatest thing you can do in the game is you could win the hand of gambling while you got away with lying, you get a golden panda coin. And I would like it to be an actual real metal coin. So Kickstarter is one way to make sure that we can get enough interest to actually be able to pay for a real metal coin. But then another thing is that I sort of, just to make it nicer for people who haven't bought the game yet, who haven't bought the original Pandante, a new edition that has all of the new stuff incorporated in the same box as the old stuff. A new edition that you wouldn't, if you already had the game, you don't necessarily need to buy that because you just buy the expansion. But the point is that if I do that, it means I have to make these very expensive deluxe sets with chips all over again. And so I also need the Kickstarter to make sure that we can at least have some minimum like fundraising that's anywhere near the cost of manufacturing. So that's where I'm coming from. It's like over and over. The marketing element is a factor, but the bigger factors are really just being able to pay for manufacturing.
Does that mean you don't even think about Kickstarter until like late into your into the planning for the game, or?
Yeah, that's right. In every one of those cases, I didn't think about it until I was finished. And maybe if someone's goal was just purely to make money, just like maximize how much money your Kickstarter will make, then I don't think you'd even make the kind of games I'm making for starters.
Yeah, probably not.
I mean, the problem, I mean, I've said this in a few other interviews, is that imagine that someone created the most elegant tabletop game ever. Like in 100 years, people will look back at it and just say, oh, it's such a masterpiece. Like it's so simple and yet there's so much to it and it's so deep. That's like the worst game in the world to release on Kickstarter. Like it was really sad because you'd hope that would be the best, most successful game, not the least successful. But if you want to go the most successful, what you need is a way to sell a whole bunch of extra parts in two different dimensions. One dimension is you need to say like, here's this game, but if we raise X money, it'll have a new piece. And if we raise more money, it'll have a new piece. But somehow, if we don't raise that money, the game still works and is good. So it's like I have like all these extra non-essential parts, like the opposite of elegant and simple. So you need, and the more of those, the better, because that's more hype. Everyone wants stretch goals.
Right.
Then you need a whole other dimension along another axis.
Right.
And that is add-ons of like, well, if you buy the game for $30, you get this. But if you buy it for $40, we'll give you this extra thing. And if you buy it for $50, we'll give you two extra things. And those are not stretch goals. That's just higher tier pledges. So the ideal money-making game has this mountains of extra material along both of these dimensions. And that's the opposite of how I design things. I want to have like the fewest elements possible. And then I get to Kickstarter and everyone demands all these extras. And I like begrudgingly make the smallest number of them I can possibly get away with. And I tell players that too. It's like, the more time I spend on that, it's like the less percentage of my time was spent making the actual core game good. So don't you want there to be fewer extra things?
Right, yeah.
It seemed to go well on Yomi. That was quite a test, because Yomi had some extra stuff, but not a mountain of it. And it was like a test of ideologies there, where some people were like, oh, this is kind of different than most Kickstarters. I see. It's like on purpose that it's a little minimal.
Right.
And so there was a chance for people to go, and I hate that. But they kind of didn't. Like, it got some buzz, and it did well. And so maybe there's room for this kind. But, yeah, it's a frustrating market, you know? Like, I like it, but it's frustrating at the same time. Kickstarter.
Explaining that, I just realized if chess was a new game, it would fail Kickstarter.
Oh, yeah, chess. Imagine that. So on day two, everyone's going to say, so what are the stretch goals? Yeah, and then you're going to be like, okay, well, we give you different carved chess sets or something.
Like, but
what about any game modes? It's like only one versus one? Isn't there like a two-on-two thing? And
it's just, wow.
And can I customize my pieces or something? What if I want to be a lion? Do you have that? And yeah, that's what would happen. It's a new world.
Yeah, indeed.
So wait, let me say one more thing on that that I think of on these Kickstarters. I call them the game vandalism tiers, where on Kickstarter it's like, okay, if you pay us a lot of money, we'll let you design a thing. Like, not just a thing that you get, but that like is part of the game that everyone gets. And I call that game vandalism. It's like allowing people to kind of ruin the game. And now you might say, well, but if it comes from the crowd, then that could be good, because you're taking like the best ideas and you're actually improving the game. And that's totally valid. And I absolutely do that and believe in that. And I do that ahead of time. Anybody can contribute to the development of my games. And they're not like paying to get their card in.
Right.
But once you bring it to Kickstarter and it's like, you know, fairly final, and then you're having like a particular person pay and you've like agreed ahead of time to put their thing in, regardless of how good it is, that's, you're selling a little bit of integrity with that. So the fans really like that and it's really successful, but I kind of cringe at it when I see it.
Do you think Kickstarter's here to stay?
Yeah, that's a good question. What do you think? You seem a little skeptical of it, maybe.
I'm not. I'm just a little surprised. Well, the thing is, I've never contributed to a Kickstarter, like, ever. So I'm kind of just more of an outsider to this whole thing. First off, I feel like the whole Tim Schafer situation with Double Fine, I feel like that kind of tainted things a little bit. I think when people started realizing the actual risk involved in contributing to games in that way.
Do you mean tainted because of what happened after, or like just the,
yeah.
Okay. I thought it meant just that it was
No, the funding was, that was fine. It's just, you know, the situation afterwards.
Yeah. And Peter Molyneux, I don't know if he's been all over the news lately with the Goddess, GOTUS, and how it's promised all these things, promised an art book and they just never made it. And I haven't really shipped a real version of the game. So you're maybe concerned that that cheapens the whole Kickstarter thing.
I'm worried about the future of crowdfunding, you know, because one game that comes to mind is Star Citizen, and that's like,
huge,
it's like,
right?
Absurd amounts of money being crowdsourced there, and I'm a little concerned if that fails, like, who will ever trust a crowdfund on anything ever again?
Okay, so I think that the people's reputation as creators might matter more and more over time. After people have been burned, you know, backers have been burned on things, they'll be more skeptical. So sure. But I don't know. Kickstarter has just been pretty resilient and just growing no matter what. The kind of joke term I use with my friends is that lying just seems to be a pretty successful tactic for Kickstarter creators. I don't want to do that. I don't plan to do that. But just promising any crazy thing, it seems to work, and then it seems to work again and again and again.
Yeah.
So what? Yeah, you're saying like there's a limit. You know, at some point it's going to go down. But here's a counterpoint for you. So imagine there was no crowdfunding. So there wasn't really, like,
right,
years ago. If you want to make a game, then okay. And if you want to make a game that costs more than you have,
right? Yeah,
which is pretty reasonable. You know, games, you probably need a team, need a few people. As soon as salaries get involved, that's really more than a normal person can afford to spend. So you're going to need funding somewhere. And historically, you've gotten funding from the opposite of crowdfunding, like a few sources that have a lot of money.
Right.
Like a publisher, there's not a million publishers, there's only a few, and they're very selective and so on. Or maybe not a publisher, but like an angel investor, like an individual that would fund you. So it's going to a small number of people with a pitch, and that's fine. But the problem is you're at the mercy of their tastes or their beliefs, and it only takes a small number of people to be wrong to prevent an interesting game from being made. But on a crowdfunding, in a crowdfunding world, or with Kickstarter, if three or four publishers said an idea wasn't going to be good, you can put it on Kickstarter and you can prove that there's demand for that game to be made. You're not at their mercy anymore. And I think that's so powerful that overwhelms the concerns that you're talking about, that it's like almost inevitable that there will be crowdfunding. It's just that the terrible examples are going to dampen it down a little bit, but not remove it. Like, I just can't imagine those being so bad that crowdfunding fails and everyone goes back to asking publishers. Publishers have just lost so much power in this world where you can get the people to fund you.
Right. Yeah. The industry in general has basically forced publishers to like try to attempt to gain like the up and coming developers, people with newer, interesting ideas, and hoping to, like, I wouldn't say leech, but hoping to help them get the exposure that they want.
Yeah. So if you're an established game publisher, you've got some things going for you. You probably have money to fund things. You have the know-how of, if you want to make a certain type of game, you probably know, you know, the kinds of staff you need and the way to achieve the basics of it. When it comes to distribution, like, if you're the kind of publisher that puts games at a retail store or on a certain console, maybe you probably have the business relationships to get that going. And all that is just totally separate from knowing how to make a good game. So publishers have those things. Know-how about marketing or advertising and so on. Know-how about attending trade shows. So there's things there, but it's good that they're not the only choice. I didn't really like the world where game developers are just at the mercy of publishers. So I think crowdfunding is terrific. There's another option.
If you had to do everything all over again, would you try to appeal more to Kickstarter? Like, would you have gone more on that end as opposed to trying to fund things yourself more?
If Kickstarter were available,
yeah,
when I first released Yomi, Would I have used? Yeah, I suppose I would have, because it was really make or break. It was, I put all my money into the art, manufacturing, and shipping of that game, and I would just be sunk if that didn't work. So it was pretty crazy. And if I had a way to risk less, I would have done it.
Okay.
It is a hassle, though. Like, you're adding a lot of overhead and dealing with all those specific concerns of different backers and exceptions they want and add-ons to the product and so on. So there's a cost. But at the end of the day, it's just so valuable to be able to reduce risk. And another way of putting that is to increase component quality without being unreasonably risky, at least for tabletop games, or features quality, you know, in video games. Yeah, you hear I'm torn, yeah. But I would go for it.
I don't know. I'm not completely against it. It's just I'm a little worried about its future more than anything else, because it feels like such a big wave that if this crashes, it's going to keep a lot of potential designers out of the exposure that they, you know, that they deserve, or have more options.
Yeah,
I'm worried about those
you.
Options going away completely, or going away at such a great degree once, you know, too many bad eggs come out, you know?
Yeah. I guess I just don't think it's going to be that extreme. My worry is a much different one. Not that it's going to collapse, but that this sort of slightly slimy salesmanship that goes along with it is going to just become bigger and bigger and bigger of a factor. Like, the original idea of Kickstarter was, I want to make a project and it's going to cost X. And so if we're only able to raise like 50% of X, then everyone gets their money back, because that's not enough to make the project. And if we raise X, then we get to make it. That's the point. That's the idea. But that's not the reality of Kickstarter anymore at all. Most projects, including mine, we set our target goal a lot lower than the reality, because we know there's this psychology thing where if the goal is too high, for some reason people don't want to jump on board and you lose out on early momentum.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make any sense, because the whole mechanism here is to protect you from having to lose any money if you don't raise the amount. But whatever.
I'm sorry, but the idea that more and more people jump in once the goal is actually achieved. So it's like, oh, well, I'm guaranteed to get this now. So yeah,
you're not risking anymore, right? Yeah, we were risking anyway, but
it's a weird psychology. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so that's just an example where the original idea like doesn't line up with reality anymore. You know, if we raise X, we'll be able to make it, but kind of not really. You know? But more than that, there's a mentality that surrounds Kickstarter of being like, I don't know, entitled to things, I guess. I don't want to talk bad about Kickstarter backers, because they've been very good to me, and I like Kickstarter. But I just want to point out there's this thing on any project where people will say, oh, so if I back it for X dollars, I get the thing. But why should I do that? Why not just wait until everyone else backs it and then I'll buy it later? Like, if there was an exclusive thing that I get, then maybe I'd do it. And if you think about that, it's like, wait, so you need it to be exclusive? Like, you need to exclude people? Like, the value?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll just say the same thing you're saying, but just rephrase it. But the same functionality is like, you want a thing that I will refuse to sell everyone else, and that I will exclude them if they try to buy it, and then you're on board. Like, that's it's a little perverse. Like, why should you care that I've excluded other people?
I think that's the pre-order mentality, right? Like in video games, right? The pre-order exclusives and stuff.
Definitely.
I think that's just only permeating, I guess.
Yeah, it's getting right. So it's like a trick, and then it was successful, and so then more people did it, and it was like more successful. And my worry has less to do with this whole thing like just collapsing than that just overtaking everything. It's gotten to be so much about these exclusives and add-ons and so on, that there's this, it disappoints me that it's not enough about, well, is the core product good? Is the timetable delivery reasonably planned out? You know, it's all about the glitz and extra pieces that surround it. And so I'm forced to play that game at least a little bit to participate. I wish I had to play it less, but I think as time goes on, everyone will have to play that game more because we're just overwhelmed by extras and exclusives and so on that people demand them.
Yeah, that's true.
That's less true in a world where the publisher pays for the game and you make the game. And I mean, yeah, they can do it for pre-orders, but they don't really have to. But try running a Kickstarter where you tell them, okay, if we raise X dollars, we're going to make the thing, and there's no stretch goals, and there's no add-ons. You'd probably be just burned to the ground. Like, people would hate you if you tried that.
Yeah, that just sounds weird, you know? At this point.
Right. I mean, I'd say they're a hero, but no one else would. Everyone else would hate them.
This needs to happen. I mean, you still have Codex coming up. There you go. Just, all right, you guys.
Yeah, but I don't want to be burned to the ground. Here's Codex. I worked like 10 years on it, and there's no stretch goals, and there's only one thing to buy. Right? Actually, there's like, I'll probably offer like three expansions of it all at once. So maybe there's three or four things to buy. But man, people are going to want, like, can I get fancier components for it? And can I add on card sleeves? And can I add a million other things? Can I get a poster? What about a mouse pad?
Right.
Yeah. That adds to my development time because I got to sort that stuff out ahead of time rather than, like, take everyone's money and then figure it out. I think that's the Peter Molyneux ways. You take everyone's money and then sort of figure it out later.
Oh, man. Yeah, I read that interview. It's I mean, yeah, it's kind of bad because he talks about the future of games. He talks about, like, the way he speaks is so passionate and so interesting, just no matter what project it is or whatever, you know? Like,
it's going to be life-changing. It's earth-shattering, this brand new thing that you've never,
like,
seen.
I want to believe, you know? It's, you know, I want to, you know, he's one of those people that make the medium feel like an art form, and what he talks about is just so big and, you know, abstract that it's like, dude, there's no way you have the proper resources to, you know, execute on what you're talking about. Unless, you know, I don't see you for a decade or something. So,
yeah, he's really opposite of me in the saying yes versus no to things. I've heard him say that in press conferences or when the press talks to him, the press says, like, well, will the game have X feature? And he doesn't want to say no. Like, he doesn't want to disappoint him. So sometimes in discussions with the press, he designs the game, or the press designs the game, basically, you know, by asking him just the right questions about what he's going to have to say yes to. And so I'm the other way, where I have an idea of what I want to make, and I picture it. I got this idea from a guy named Christopher Alexander, who wrote about design and architecture. And he talked about the idea of having, like, imagine a square piece of wood, and it has 100 little indentations in it, and you have 100 metal ball bearings, and you're trying to line them all up in the indentations. And if you had, like, 80 of the ball bearings in the indentations, and you were tilting the wood around to try to get the last 20 in, you'd have to be very careful, because if you shook the whole thing, you'd undo all your progress.
Right. Yeah.
And so most of the things people are going to bring up, you really need to say no to maintain the progress you have so far. And it's not because people are stupid or whatever. I mean, maybe there are things that projects are complicated. There's a lot of reasons why you need to say no that maybe they didn't think of or didn't understand or conflicts with some other thing that's important.
Right. Yeah.
But you got to say no to most things if you ever want to get the last 20 balls lined up. And so I'm thinking that the whole time, like, I'm just thinking, what's going to mess this up? And I'm always on the lookout for that. but I feel like Molyneux is thinking the opposite of like all these possibilities of wonderful things that could exist, but maybe not thinking through their consequences. Yeah.
I guess, isn't it technically easier for you because, you know, it's just you in a sense, while he's dealing with, I don't know, like,
isn't it easier to make a game without having the buy-in of a whole team? Is that what you're...
In a sense, the thing is, though, like, your designs are just your designs, you know? You're not... It seems like with the way he deals with things, it feels like he serves way too many masters. Even, like, even when you look back at his older projects, it feels like he's having to juggle... this huge vision against the publisher's demands, against what the audience is expecting, and all these things, and what his programmers say, that's a thing too, and he just ends up falling short, while you know. It's easier for you to just be like, well, this is what I'm thinking. This is how I want the game to be. And then you just do it, in a sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm more agile, and then I have fewer masters to serve. Though it's not quite as easy as you make it out to be, because. So if I just went off on my own and came up, well, the kind of games I've made so far have mostly been competitive, have been asymmetric competitive games, which is one of the most complicated types of games you can make, because there's any little tiny error and it can ruin the whole thing. If there's one little thing on one little character, on one character that's too good, it really ruins the game. Whereas if you made like a, I don't know, the next Mario game and there was some trick to cheat a level, whatever. I mean, that would affect 1% of people. But a slip up in my type of game affects ultimately how it's played in tournaments.
Yeah, and you're talking everything. Hundreds so of games, yeah.
So because that's the way, that's the property of the games that I've made, I actually cannot just go off in a corner and make them and then present them to the world. It's impossible. There'd be way too many flaws in them. So I have to get a lot of other people to help me out and test them and iron them out and so on. And those people only do that because they like the game and are interested in it. So I have to get the buy-in of a lot of people to be able to make this stuff. So I just want to point that out. But sure, it's different. That's even that said, it's not like I also have to do what this publisher said or so on. So yeah, I'm still more agile.
Yeah. You're pretty positive about crowdsourcing. Do you think that model is going to go into more and more areas?
More areas, like other industries?
Yeah.
So, for example, Kickstarter does not allow charities, no charitable causes. I don't know why that is. I don't know what's up with that. But surely someone is... either already created or in the process of creating a Kickstarter for charities. I mean, it just seems inevitable.
Right, yeah.
Kickstarter also focuses on creative endeavors. Like if you wanted a, B2B e-commerce platform or some boring thing like that, Kickstarter's not really the place for you. But you might need an investor still. And I can imagine crowdsourcing that sort of thing too. So, yeah, I mean, maybe this is just like a virus that's just been unleashed on the world. It's going to start taking over more things. Is that what your take is or no?
I think potentially. I'm not too sure.
It's kind of like the democratization of yet another thing in the world. Like the media used to be newspapers and then newspapers and radio and television, but the power of those media outlets is so diminished. And I mean, it's still there, but it's just so diminished in the world of Twitter and blogs. It's like everyone has the ability to distribute news. So maybe crowdfunding is like that. You know, it's giving everybody the power to fund things. Might not erase the old ways, but it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle now.
Right. So, what other potential projects do you have in mind? Like, is there any, is the main focus just Codex right now, or are you thinking of are there a couple other things brewing? Or concepts that you feel like are going to be next?
I'm just so overwhelmed with finishing up Pandante expansion and Flashdual revamp. I will be very happy to be finished with that. I'm at a place where the design is like 99% finished, and it's all this busy work, like all these graphics and packaging and so on. So I would love to get back to Codex, finish that up. And Codex is a big game. It's got, let's see. So there's 6 colors in that game, and each color is 3 heroes, so that's 18 heroes. And sort of like in Marvel vs. Capcom 3, you can pick a team of 3 that will make your deck. So that's like 18 choose 3, which is, I think, 815 possibilities. And every one of those 815 possibilities is playable. So that's way, like, when I say playable, what I mean is, like, in a fighting game, like, take a reasonably well-balanced fighting game, and if you were to pick one of the worst characters, they could still win. I mean, they could win a tournament, maybe. Like, Zangief in Super Turbo Street Fighter, he's, like, the worst, but he's really scary, and any mistake, and he'll beat you.
Right.
So the 815 different possible hero configurations are kind of like that. They're like the worst one of those is more analogous to a low tier fighting game character than a random pile of Magic the Gathering cards. Like a random pile of Magic the Gathering cards is like not even a playable thing, because like you don't even have the right mana or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
And if you took not just a random pile, but let's say the top decks of Magic, the metagame can't really support, I don't know, I mean, even 10 decks would be just a huge number, I think.
Yeah.
That's an incredible achievement. 10, I mean, more likely is like 3, maybe 4. Is it generous?
I think most Magic metagames, they like to think about the, you know, the 3 pillars or this or some sort of rock, paper, scissors game. But, you know, seems like as of late, there has been a quote unquote correct answer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they've had to like make serious adjustments. And that's why now they're kind of not only speeding up rotation patterns, but they're also like sort of pushing more cards out there, so that, you know, the metagame doesn't get found out so quickly and stuff.
Yeah, so I had to do a way different approach because I come from such a different belief on how it should all work. So in fighting games, if we rated matchups like Zangief versus Blanca or something, we say a number like 5-5 or 7-3 or something, meaning if 2 experts played 10 games, how many would we expect the first character to win versus the second? So if it's 5-5, it means it's fair. And if you looked at a matchup chart for a fighting game, like every character versus every other character in a big grid, and you saw a whole bunch of matchups that were like very unfair, like 8-2 or something, that would be bad. You'd say, hey, maybe you should work on the balance. Like, this is the problem. And then in the customizable card game world, it's really opposite, because the player's goal is to make it as unfair as possible. Like, your goal is to sit down to the table at an 8-2 match in your favor, right? Because you're in a construct format. So if you build your deck in such a way that, let's say you had like a 9-1 matchup against several popular decks, and then you had a 1-9 matchup, a terrible matchup, against some other decks, but you don't expect those to be very popular, that could be like a genius move on your part, and you could maybe win or get second place or something at that tournament, and everyone would congratulate you and say how smart you were. But what you did was you made 100% of your game's terrible gameplay. They're all 1-9 or 9-1. And so when I was developing Codex for a while, I was just making the decks myself, like, which is way different than a player trying to make them in the, you know, most playing to win way. And so I would make them to be fun, and then we would test them and so on. And after a while, it was like, man, it's really disappointing that when players get a hold of this, they're not going to experience this thing that we're doing right now, because they're not going to build their decks the way I'm doing it. They're going to build them in degenerate edge case ways that actually remove most of the core fun that we're having right now. And then I hit upon this idea of forcing players to have fun, is the joke way we put it. It would design the rules so that there really is no way you can customize out the fun part. The more customization you have, the more possibilities it sounds like you have, but actually the more likely it is that some particular one of them is broken. So really less customization it ends up with more real viable choices in the end. And so the way that Codex actually works is it's a little more analogous to the theme is a real-time strategy game, by the way, like StarCraft or Warcraft 3. And it kind of works a little bit like those games. Have you played Warcraft 3 by chance? Are you familiar with that game?
I played StarCraft. I don't think I've played Warcraft.
Oh, they're similar, but I just bring up Warcraft 3 because it had heroes. You have three heroes, and you have three heroes in Codex also. So it's a little closer, but StarCraft's pretty close.
Oh, okay.
So in StarCraft, think of pick a particular race like a Protoss. So think of every unit you could possibly ever build as Protoss. Now, you wouldn't build every unit each game you play.
Right.
That's just like the pool of things you're pulling from. And so we play one game and I would play one subset of those units, and a different game I play a different subset. And if I played you several times, I would not do the same thing every time, you know, because I'd be feeling out like, oh, what do you do? And next game I'll shift a little bit. So the set of all possible Protoss things that you could build is analogous in Codex to the cards in your Codex, like in your book of cards that you sit down to the table with.
Okay.
And then when you actually play a game, you are only playing a subset of those cards in the game, and you choose it on the fly as the opponent is choosing theirs on the fly. And you kind of have like three, because you have three heroes, it's sort of like three paths. And each one of those three is a coherent, balanced thing. So when you combine chunks of these, like no matter how you combine them, the chunk itself is reasonably balanced. So that I don't know if that makes sense, but that technique is, if I explain that well, is kind of how we are able to have so many different combinations of heroes that work, because they work on their own. And then we get a lot of gameplay, like sitting down at the table thinking type gameplay, in that, oh, which direction are you really going, and how far are you in this and how far are you in that? And because I have access to what's analogous to all the Protoss units, it's more than you would have access to in a Magic deck. So in a Magic deck, you have the deck itself, and then you have a sideboard that you usually can't access during the gameplay, but you know, between games. So imagine that you had like a deck and two other decks, that many effects at least, maybe not four copies of all the cards, but you know, two decks worth of effects sitting along the side, and you could use any of them during the game. And because you have access to enough effects, it's like somewhere in there is going to be an answer to whatever people are throwing at you. So that's a problem I've had with customizable card games like Magic, is that we can customize our decks in such opposite directions that they don't interact very much anymore.
Right.
Like maybe I'm geared towards killing creatures and you don't have any creatures.
Yeah.
So by having access to more powers, it basically means that no matter what kind of crap you pull, there's an answer for me somewhere in there. And that keeps things more balanced. It means it's way harder to have an 8-2 matchup in Codex than it is in Magic. And that was important to me. That was a high ranking design goal, is to make sure that any particular matchup is fair, no matter which type of deck you wanted to play. So that's the next big project. Also, I'm sort of kicking around this idea of taking the concept of my card game Yomi, but applying it to a little more literal translation of fighting games to board games. So, like, Battlecon is a competitor of mine, and that in that game there is a track where you're moving your characters back and forth, and so distance is an element.
Okay.
So distance is, like, how far you are from the opponent is, like, one of the most important things in fighting games. And
right.
I chose to not capture that in Yomi, because I was like, there's only so much I can do, and I need to simplify it, so I'm going to focus on a different aspect of the game, which is the mind games and building combos. So those are the, like, two things that Yomi Card Game is about. But I also made a game called Flash Duel that has distance, and it's a very interesting game, but it's really simple, and it's not supposed to be like Street Fighter, really. So I haven't made a game where I thought, well, what if we take fighting games and do the opposite of what I did with Yomi, you know, and say, what if distance was what it's all about instead of abstracted away? So Battlecon did that, and we've seen what their method is. And I've been kicking around an idea of how I could do that too, but by the time I get around making that, you know, it's got all these other things queued up. Also, we mentioned that demo maybe of a video game that's simple, kind of trying to get that going. Yomi in the online form is going to launch on Steam pretty soon, which I think that's going to be really big. It's cross-platform, so people who are playing on Steam can play against people on iOS or on the web version at fantasystrike.com.
Cool.
So, yeah, I've got just so many things in the works. Is there anything you'd like to see, any type of game you're wishing for?
No, I didn't have anything in mind. I kind of just, you know, I just keep up with everything you do, and just, you know, once it, like, comes out, I normally just pick it up anyway. Like, I'm waiting on the Yomi.
Oh, yeah. Well, so the second edition is out now, and then at least 8 of the 20 decks and the other 12 will be released over the course of several months. There's a release schedule posted on Cerulean.net. I believe beginning of March will be Menelker and Persephone will come out.
Cool.
Actually, I do have one other thing I've been kicking around at even earlier stages. I've thought many times about how to make a cooperative game. I haven't done that yet. There's a lot of special challenges in cooperative tabletop games. So I've been thinking through that, and I've always wanted to make something that it's kind of RPG-ish a little bit, like you pick your class, and your class works really differently than the other classes, and you learn how to play them and play against bosses. Sort of like a World of Warcraft trading card game, the raids.
Yeah.
You're fighting against bosses. I really like what they did with that. And sort of imagined a game that's all designed around that. Like, their raids are just one mode of several modes. But what if they had really focused on that? So I've been sort of thinking about that. But as you can see, I'm a little busy with other stuff.
Yeah, a little bit. Okay. Yeah, I don't really have any more questions. Is there anything you wanted to put out there?
I think we've covered a lot. I'll just ask your viewers to check out the Kickstarter for the Pandante Light and Dark expansion, and also the reprint of Flash Duel when that is available. And they can already play Yomi on iOS or FantasyStrike.com, or the physical version you can get from CerulenGames.com or Amazon in the U.S. And thank you for having me on your show.
A big thank you to David for giving me his time. One more thing he forgot to promote was his Patreon. In exchange for a monthly contribution, he's offering early access to his games and a ton of insight on the games as he's making them. Go to www.patreon.com/Cerulean, Cirlin. Another thing of note, we were talking about games that could work as a bridge between Dive Kick and Street Fighter. While I can't wait for the Fantasy Strike fighting game to come to fruition and be that ideal game, I found a little thing called Senior Footsies that might cover what he was talking about. If you're interested in learning the basics of fighting game movement, check it out at least until Fantasy Strike comes out. That's all I have for today. Another shout out to mdgcast.com and Classic Media House. Follow us on Twitter at BuildBetterGame and like us on Facebook.com/BuildingBetterGamers. If you'd like to support the show through merchandise, go to buildingbettergamers.spreadshirt.com. I plan on adding a few more items to the store very soon. And that's it. Until next time, be every bit the hero you play, because everyone is a hero. Even if the only person you've ever saved is yourself. Peace.